is actually divided into five different books, and there's some correlation to, some people think, to the five books of the Pentateuch. And this fourth book is primarily related to Israel when they were wandering in the wilderness. And so that's what we're going to look at this morning, is this psalm that Moses is writing. The Israelites are in the wilderness. They've been in Egypt, they've come out, and they're wandering around. And as I see it, Moses is telling them, look where you've been, and where are we going to go? The first thing we start out with is we see that they look at who God is, the sovereignty of God. Let's look in Psalm chapter 90, verse 1. Lord, thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. Now this verse starts out with the word Lord. As you remember, when we've been looking in Genesis, I tend to make a big deal out of what name of God is being used here. Now this is Lord, but in my Bible, it's Lord, but it's not in all capital letters. If you remember back in Genesis, you've got Lord that's in all capital letters, and that means like Jehovah, that's talking about the covenant-keeping God, and sometimes they use the word God, which is Elohim, the creator, the supreme God, but here it's using the word Lord, which in Hebrew is Adonai. And the word there means sovereign Lord or ruler of the earth. So the first thing that Moses is telling the children of Israel is that the ruler of the earth, that's who he's talking about, has been our dwelling place. If I said I was going to come to your dwelling place, where am I coming? I'm coming to your house, the place you stay. Now, in the Hebrew, the word actually means like a den. Like an animal might have a den where they stayed. Or in a person's house, you might have a room that you call a den. It's a place of comfort, a place of security, a place where you feel safe. And so Moses is telling the Israelites, the Lord, the supreme ruler, has been our safe place, our secure place, where we can dwell. You see, think about the children of Israel. Where have they been? Well, right now they're in the wilderness and they're wandering around and they don't have too much of a safe place. They've got a tent and they pick it up and they move on and they stay there a while, maybe a couple months, maybe a couple days, whatever, and then they move on to the next spot. Not very secure. Before that, where were they? They were in the land of Egypt, the slaves. Not exactly the most secure place. And so Moses is reminding them that the supreme ruler of the universe is the safe place that they can have confidence in. And he's been that from all generations, as far back as the Jewish people could go. In their minds, the Lord has been there for them. In verse 2, before the mountains were brought forth, and we think about the mountains, we think of something that's fixed and rugged and secure, and you know, you can count on the mountains. Now, from our study in Genesis, you know, we've seen that the mountains probably came about as a result of the flood and the shifting of the plates from the flood and stuff. But as far as these Israelites knew, the mountains were there. They were safe. They were secure. Before the mountains came forth, or ever thou formed the earth or the world. What's it talking about here? This is identifying the Lord as the creator. And in my mind, I'm saying, okay, why does he use the word earth and the word world? There must be some reason for this. Well, the earth in Hebrew comes from the idea of something that is firm. It's the actual physical earth, the dirt. You know, the rocks and that kind of stuff. So it's acknowledging that the Lord formed the physical earth. But also then the word world can mean the inhabitable part or the inhabitants. And I take it to mean that not only did he create the physical earth, but he created the inhabitants of the earth. So Moses has taken the Israelites back and reminded them that the supreme God, the ruler, he made the earth. He made you. And then he goes on and says, from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. How long is that? What's he saying? From everlasting. From eternity. Here's a major Bible doctrine. God is eternal. Well, how? I can't understand that. I've tried to think through this. You know, as a human being, we're pretty limited in our knowledge. Okay, I understand the things that I've experienced. I can remember things back about till I was 5 years old, right? You might remember a few things before that, but not a whole lot. And the reason I know that was when we were 5 years old, my family moved to a different house. And there's only a very few things that I remember at the first house that we lived at. I remember it had rooms, and they were in a circle, and we could, my sister and I would run around in these rooms. It drove my mother crazy. I don't know why it was so much fun, but I remember just running and running and running circles in there. And I also remember one day, for some reason, my sister and I decided we were going to remove wallpaper. When my father came home, I was cured of removing wallpaper. Okay? But you go back that far is about how long I can remember that I'm actually aware of what's going on. And I think back a little further, and my grandparents, especially my grandfathers, both would tell me stories of when they were children growing up, and it was a totally different world then. And so I feel like I have a little bit of sense of that, but I didn't really experience it. You know, and you go back a little further, and in family history, I can read that I've got ancestors that came, that were here before the founding of the country. But I didn't experience that. 500 years ago, you know, Martin Luther, you know, we sang, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses. There are things that intellectually I know, but I haven't experienced them. But think about it. God is from everlasting. He's been here through it all. He's seen it all. He's been in control of it all. So from everlasting, as far back as you can go, God was there. And it says to everlasting, as far as you can go into the future, God is there. And what does Moses say? As long as time exists, and before time exists, and after time is done existing, thou art God. And there we have the word Elohim, the supreme God. Thou art God. So he's reminding the Israelites, in spite of what we've been through, God is there for us, and he's been there through it all. In verse 3, he says, thou turnest man to destruction, and sayest, return, ye children of men. When I first read that, it's like, what's he talking about? Thou turnest man to destruction. The Hebrew word here for destruction is actually the idea of crushing. Or powder. Or dust. Huh. Does that sound a little bit familiar? Remember back in Genesis when we were in there in Genesis chapter 3 and man had sinned? What did God say was the part of the curse on man? In Genesis chapter 3, verse 19, it says, at the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread till thou return unto the ground, for out of it thou wast taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust thou shalt return. And so there, Moses is reminding the people that God is the one that brings death upon the human race. Why does this death appear? Why does it come? I mean, is this God is vengeful or something? In Romans chapter 5, verse 12, it talks about, wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, so death passed upon all men, for all have sinned. And so, this destruction, this death, is a result of man's sin. Now, why does God do that? Why do we need to die? Because God is holy. And he's just. And because he's holy and just, he's required to punish sin. But it's deserved. We have disobeyed God, and so therefore we're deserving of this death and destruction that he places on us. And the verse continues and says, return, ye children of God. Now the commentators disagree on what this phrase actually is talking about. When it says return is to go back to the place where you started. Now, some of the commentators are saying, well, he's just restating what he said in the first phrase. You know, you're going to go back to dust. But some of the other commentators, and I am in this camp, believe that when it says return, it's speaking of a resurrection. That God is going to resurrect the bodies of individuals. In Daniel chapter 12, verse 2. For many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth, remember in the verse we talked about that the destruction was dust, shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame, and to everlasting contempt. And so Moses was reminding the people, God has always been there. He's the creator. And he's also the one that controls your life. He's given you your life and he controls your life. And I think he's reminding them that, hey, the day's going to come that you're going to be resurrected. In verse 4, for 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it is past, and as a watch in the night. And here again, he's reminding the people of the eternality of God. God's not really constrained by time as we are as people. We think of 1,000 years and that seems like forever. But to God, it's just like, it's just like yesterday. When it says a watch in the night, that would be a 4-hour shift of like when a military guard or something. At that time, that would have been considered 4 hours. So 1,000 years to God, it's the same. It's about 4 hours to us. In verse 5, we move on. Thou carriest them away with a flood. Well, what's he talking about here? He's talking about as Moses is reflecting on seeing people pass from this life. And it just seems like there's a flood that's carrying people away. Moses can reflect on the account of, in Genesis of Noah and the destruction. You know, Moses is the one that would have recorded that. And so he would have been aware of that. He'd also seen the Israelites and they're crossing the Red Sea and the whole Egyptian army being drowned in that sea. And so he's seeing humanity almost like they're being carried away with a flood. It says they're like asleep. When you're asleep, you're not aware of what's going on. When you look at the world around us today, there's just a lot of people that are involved in things and activities, but they have no real consciousness of God and are just being swept away on a slow and continual basis. It goes on and he uses an example here then in the end of verse 5 and verse 6. In the morning they are like grass that groweth up. In the morning it flourisheth and groweth up. In the evening it is cut down and withereth. In the Dead Sea Basin and in the Jordan Valley, there's a type of grass there that grows up really quick in the spring when it gets a shower of rain. And it looks like it's really going to amount to something. And then as soon as it gets dry weather, it just dies and dries up. And that's the way from a perspective without God, that's the way the human race looks. It looks like we're going to amount to something, and then it just sort of fizzles out. Verse 7, we are consumed by thy anger and by thy wrath. We are troubled. Now this had a real special meaning they understood this, the Israelites. Remember, they're in the wilderness. God had taken them out of Egypt where they had been slaves. And he brought them up close to the promised land. And they sent in the spies into the promised land. And they checked it out and they come back. And two of them says, yeah, it's great. God's with us. He's going to take us in. It's all going to be good. And the other 10 say, no, there's giants in the land and we're scared and they're going to kill us. And it's never going to work. And God says, okay, you don't trust me? You don't believe me? This whole generation is going to have to die off before you can go into the promised land. And so in a very real way, the Israelites that Moses was writing this to understood what it meant to be consumed by God's anger. You see, for 40 years, they're just wandering, waiting for people to die. There were 603,000 men of military age in Israel's army at that time. And every one of those men over 20 years old had to die before the Israelites could go in to that, into the promised land, except for Caleb, Joshua, because of their disobedience. So they were consumed by his anger and by God's wrath. They were troubled. You know, as we think about in our lives, are there problems, are there afflictions that are happening in our lives that might be the result of our disobedience to God? I'm not saying that every problem that you have is a judgment from God. It's not. But there is a possibility that it may be, that God might be trying to get your attention in some way. In verse 8, "For thou hast set our iniquities before thee." Huh. Moses is saying, iniquities, that's sort of like a word for really bad sin. At least that's the way I see it. And it's like Moses is saying, like, God has put these iniquities out there, and when he thinks of us, he sees the things that we've done wrong. Have you ever had anybody that really did you dirty? I mean, they've told a nasty lie about you, or they stole something from you, or something like that. And any time you see that person, that's the only thing that comes in your mind. Well, that's sort of the way this is with God. If we're not repented from our sins, whenever he sees us, he sees that sin, that iniquity is before him. In the end of verse 8, it says, "Our secret sins in light of thy countenance." What would secret sins be? Oh, they're the sins that nobody else knows about. But God knows about them, and he's aware of them as well. Verse 9, "For all our days are passed away in thy wrath, and we spend our years as a tale that is told." The idea of a tale that's told is something that's just muttered. There's no real value to it. It's just jumbled. And from a humanistic standpoint, without God, that's the way the human life can seem, that we have no value. Moses is telling these people, look back. God was eternal. He's been there. He's created us. And when we're looking back in our lives, we've disobeyed him, and we've made a mess of things. In verse 10, "And the days of our years are 70 years and 10, and if by reason of strength, they be 80 years. Huh. Doesn't that sound about right? I mean, how long is the life expectancy of an average person? I looked it up. For a man in the United States, it's 79 years. For a woman, it's 81. Also found some interesting things about that, but one of the reasons for that is that men are less anemic than women. When people that are anemic don't have as much iron in their blood, and iron attracts bad things, okay? And so men have, because they're strong, the increased iron gives them strength, but it also attracts things that are not healthy for them too. So anyway, that's just a little interesting thing that I observed. But anyway, so if you're anemic, that's a good thing. You'll live longer if you don't die from being anemic. Okay. anyway, Moses here is telling, you know, if you live to be 70 years, or maybe even you get to be 80 years, that's about all of it. Now, Moses himself, he lived to be 120 at that time. And God's, you know, in strength, strengthened him and enabled him that way. But for the Israelites, they were under this curse. They were in the wilderness, and they were wandering around basically just waiting for them all to die off. And so if they, you know, they knew there was an end in sight. They were under a death sentence. It says, "Yet is their strength, labor, and sorrow." You know, even the people that live the long life, their strength, you know, it's just work and problems. That's the way it seems without God, that our life is just work and problems. "For it is soon cut off, and we fly away." You know, you're going to go through this life, you're going to die, and that's going to be the end of it. Now, this is all coming from the perspective without God. And it's pretty gloomy, right? Well, it does get, there is some hope here. In verse 11, who knoweth the power of thy anger, even according to thy fear, so is thy wrath. Can we really understand God's wrath? You know, the more I've thought about this as I've been working on this message, is that I don't think we understand how much God hates sin. You know, that's just a little sin. That's not a big deal. But to God, all sin is a big deal. We don't really understand His anger, His wrath. In verse 12, okay, what should we do about this? Okay, He's told us we're not going to live real long. You know, we're going to die someday. So what should we do about it? In verse 12, so teach us to number our days. What's it mean to number our days? How are we going to number our days? I mean, I don't know how long I'm going to live. If I was going to number our days, I would say, okay, I'm going to live to be a certain age, and I have this many days to do this and do this. No, it doesn't work that way. What's he saying? We don't know how many days we're having. So what are we supposed to do? We're supposed to use the days that we have wisely. Now, what day do you have that you know you have? Today, right? And so you have to use today wisely. And if God gives you tomorrow, you need to use that day wisely as well. The end of the verse says that we may apply our hearts to wisdom. That apply our hearts to wisdom. In other words, we need to use it in the right way, to think through it and do what God wants us to. You know, and I'm going to admit to you, I don't always do that. And I'll give you an illustration. I got a family that buys hay from me. And there's different boys in the family. And there's one time there's a daughter and the father. And they come on a fairly regular basis and get hay. Well, and occasionally the dad would come. And I knew that he was sick. And they had told me, hey, he's got cancer. And they would give me different updates on him. And I really wanted to share the gospel with this man because I didn't know where he was at. And they told me different things. They'd give me updates on how he's doing. And several times they would call and say, hey, we need some hay. And twice I offered to take the hay and deliver it to him for the specific purpose as I wanted a chance to talk to the old man before he died. Well, not too long ago then they told me, hey, he's only got 6 months to live. I knew he had been in the hospital, and I was into the hospital, and I checked, and he had already been discharged. I thought, man, if I can get him in the hospital room, I got a captive audience there. I'll preach to him there. You know, and I tried to number my days. They told me he had 6 months to live. And about a month into that, saw in the paper, he had passed away. Never had the opportunity to talk to him. Don't know where he is spiritually. I know that one man that was a friend of his made a profession of faith. I don't know where that man is. Did I number my days the way I should have? I had opportunities. He stood in my barn. We chit-chatted about other things, but I didn't share the Lord with him. I thought I had more time. Did I number my days? No. How many times do we do that? So the verse says, teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts to wisdom, that we might do the right thing. In verse 13, return, O Lord, how long? And let it repent thee concerning thy servants. Here Moses is telling us, you know, Lord, come back. He wants a relationship. You see, the relationship with God and the Israelites were strained at this time because they had sinned and they were wandering in the wilderness. And Moses is wanting to come back into, you know, a closer relationship as a nation with him. It says, oh, satisfy us early with thy mercy that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. He's begging for mercy. You know, a lot of times when we go to God, and, you know, we beg for a lot of stuff from God. God, I need this, and I want that, and I... But how often do we ask God for His mercy? You see, we've sinned. We've broken his heart, and we need to ask him for mercy. That he doesn't. I mean, he could take us out at any time. He could afflict us with any kind of problem. But in his mercy, he's allowed us to live. And he's allowed us to live for the purpose that he wants us to bring glory to him. We're moving on then in verse 15. It says, make us glad according to the days wherein thou hast afflicted us. And this is a little hard to understand, but it's a prayer. And he's saying, you know, we've had a lot of problems and we've had bad days. Give us as many good days as we've had bad days. You know, in this life, you're going to see problems. But God's also going to give you blessings. And we need to thank him when he does give us those blessings. In verse 16, we see another prayer then. Let thy work appear unto thy servants, and thy glory unto thy children. What are we seeing here? Let thy work appear unto thy servants. What's a servant do? A servant serves. A servant does what the master wants him to do. And Moses is saying, let your people see what you want them to do. Are we willing to put ourselves in front of God and say, hey God, here I am. Whatever you have for me, I'm willing to do it. I'm willing to be your servant. Are we willing to do that? God has you here for a purpose in this world. And he wants you to be a blessing to other people. He wants you to represent him well. In the end of the verse it says, in thy glory unto their children. Not only does he want the servants to do what God's servants to do what he wants them to do, but he wants it to be passed on to the next generation. Thy glory. He wants our children, he wants our grandchildren to see that God is alive in our life. Yeah, I visit a lot of the older folks from this congregation, and pretty often I'll ask if they have any prayer requests or, you know, something that they'd like me to pray for. And one of the most common prayer requests I get is people say, I'd like you to pray for my children. I'd like you to pray for my grandchildren. You know, they make a profession of faith, but they have no interest in church. They're not involved. You know, I want to see my faith passed down to the next generation. And how's the next generation going to see that? Oh, there's a lot of temptations in this world that can pull them away from the Lord. But the first thing is, we need to be faithful. They need to see that it's real in our life. Because if they don't see it's real, and especially the young people under 30 years old, if it's not real, they don't want any parts of it. It has to be vibrant. You know, tradition is not of interest to them. It has to be real in their hearts. So I want to challenge you. Make your faith real, that your young people can see it. That's not saying that every one of them is going to fall in line the way you'd like them to. But at least you can do what you can do. In verse 17, and let the beauty of the Lord our God. Oh, here he uses the word Lord in capital letters. Jehovah, the covenant keeper. God's made a promise with Israel. And Moses is saying, he's going to keep it. Let the beauty, the idea of the beauty is, let God's blessing be upon us. He's asking, God, bless us. And establish thou the work of thy hands. He's saying, when something's established, it's made permanent. It's an ongoing thing. And Moses is saying, may people see us doing God's work in our lives. Our lives should have meaning that's eternal. It lasts forever. I mentioned about numbering our days in the message, and you know, how are we going to use our days? I'm going to read you a story about a man named John Beekman. He was a graduate of Moody Bible Institute, and he was given a death sentence by his doctor. He had a serious heart condition, and it was unlikely that he would live. He had one chance, a very slim one. They can insert a small plastic valve in his heart. And this is years and years ago when heart surgery wasn't a common thing. At that time, there were only two other people who had survived this operation. He might, if he was careful, become survivor number three. Moody Institute of Science made a film about his life and called it Survivor Number Three. Once this plastic valve was inserted, John Beekman counted his days and applied his heart to wisdom. Instead of slowing down and at a careful pace and hoarding his days like a miser, he threw himself into pioneer missionary work among the Chol Indians in the tropical jungles of southern Mexico. His story became one of determination and character, of a life spent prodigally with one eye firmly fixed on the 0 hour announced by his doctor and the other fixed on eternity. He and his wife Elaine ignored all the doctor's warnings. They plunged through steaming jungles. They lived in primitive conditions. They reduced the Chol language to writing. They translated the Bible into that language. They taught them how to read, and they led them to Christ. And they saw a new civilization emerge where once had been paganism and despair. Here's a man that numbered his days. He didn't know how many days he had left, but he chose to use them for the Lord's glory. So in conclusion, I want to challenge you. Look both ways. Look back. In the message, we've seen that God is eternal. He's always been there. He's the creator of the world, and he's the creator of life, and he's the one that has given you life. We need to thank him for that. We also need to look back and see that, you know, every one of us has disobeyed God. The Israelites, they did it nationally, but we've done it individually. We've disappointed God and we've sinned, and that's going to bring about our judgment. It's going to bring about death. So, when you look toward the future, what's going to happen? Are you just going to go through this life? You're going to live your days. And when you die, you die. Oh, but we just read a verse that a while back in Daniel that said that everyone's going to be resurrected to judgment. Some to everlasting life and some to condemnation. Are you ready for that time? Are you going to, the time when you're going to stand before God? We need to number our days. We don't know how many days we have here. You know, I've seen people that, hey, someday I'm going to become a Christian. You know, when I'm older, I want to live a while first. I want to do some things that I know God wouldn't approve of. And so eventually I'm going to do that. You don't know how many days you have. I'd encourage you to think about it. Have you made a commitment to Jesus Christ as your personal Savior? Some of you might say, you know, it's the end of the year and I've, you know, a lot of things in my life I'm going to do someday. You know, I ought to start reading the Bible on a regular basis. You know, that's what I'll do, but I'd encourage you, beginning of the year, be a good time to make a decision. Hey, I'm going to read the Bible every day. You know, maybe you want to read the Bible the whole way through in a year. That's a good thing. It doesn't work good for me because I get distracted. And I get to reading and it's like, that's interesting. And then this is related to this. And I get I get down rabbit trails. Or the other way that I do when I read the Bible through is I can read the words, which I tend to speed read, and I don't read everything. So for me, it works better if I slow down and take smaller chunks. And it might take you 3 years. It might take you 5 years. How about God has given you this book, and if you've never read through it the whole way, I'd encourage you, hey, this would be a good time to do that. You know, I shared about the man that I failed to share the gospel with. Maybe there's somebody that you know, a relative, somebody you work with, and someday you're going to tell them. You don't know if your days are going to run out or if their days are going to run out. And encourage you to think about numbering your days. In John chapter 3, verse 36, it says, "He that believeth on the Son hath everlasting life, and he that believeth not the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God abideth on him." I want to encourage you to number your days wisely, whether that's with your relationship with God or maybe in bringing other people into relationship with him. Let's close in prayer.